forgotten over there. Let me go over there. Go. Come back. Come back. Come back. Come back. Come back. Right. Right. Well, this is a presentation which I gave 6 times, in fact, last summer to the Universidad Internacional Menéndez Pelayo for their summer courses. And I think it is pretty generally useful. The basic idea is to present approximately 60 terms of medical English which cause problems to Spanish speakers, whether that be because they're false friends or they're strange words or whatever, for different reasons, or problems of pronunciation. The first 10 minutes will be a little bit technical, but then it'll all get much, much more exciting, as you will see. So we will start. Right. In terms of, Right. In terms of pronunciation, there's no special rules of pronunciation for medical English, of course, but some of the most common words create pronunciation problems. And so it is quite useful to revise the most important rules of English pronunciation. One of those is that when we have ER consonant, IR consonant, UR consonant, often when we have OUR consonant, and when we have OR consonant after a W, or in all of those cases, the sound that we produce tends to be ER. So the group of words that you have on the left-hand side over here are germs, herpes. I'm imagining you all repeating them after, well, you, I'm saying you all, you both, repeating them after me. So germs, herpes, infirmary, scurvy, sternum, surgery, and worm. Surgery is an interesting word. Surgery, where you're probably most likely to come across it, is in relation to operations in which you cut open the body. But a GP's surgery in British English is what the Americans call a doctor's office. So when you go to your family doctor, your GP, or what in English we call a general practitioner, British English, then that is actually called a surgery, even though it doesn't involve cutting people open. It's a little bit complicated. But anyway, all those words, the red letters in all of those words should sound exactly the same. Right, another very, very basic pronunciation rule which you should already be aware of is that when we have a vowel consonant, E in a... especially in the stressed syllable, especially in monosyllabic words, the E at the end is silent, but it makes the vowel say its name. So in relation to the words we have there, we have mad, but made. M-A-D-E, the vowel that says its name is A, so made. Fat, fate. Met, meet. Them, theme. The TH sound changes, but that doesn't affect the question of the vowel sound. Kit, kite. Spin, spine. Rob, robe. O, rob, robe. Hop, hope. Cut, cute. And tub, tube. You don't necessarily have to know all of those words, so long as you can see what's happening with the sound change. That is one of the most... second, we'll just wait for the cows to go by. The cows have now gone by. That is one of the most productive and useful pronunciation rules in the English language. The way that we avoid that effect is by doubling a consonant. Whenever a consonant is doubled, it means that the vowel sound before it cannot be a diphthong or long. So that would also help you to explain the difference between writing and written. Yeah, writing, the past participle would be pronounced written, if it weren't for the second T. The second T means that necessarily it has to be pronounced written. So we have write, wrote, written, writing, compared to written. Similarly, with riding compared to ridden. And it also explains other medical terms that have a double letter. So, for example, your funny bone. Does anybody know what your funny bone is? You know what a funny bone is? Nope. Francisca, sorry. This is our last chance. No? I imagine it's no. Your funny bone is, in fact, not a bone. It's your ulnar nerve. Because when you hit it, you're likely to grimace can make people laugh, etc. I'm not sure why it's actually funny, but there's this it's the nerve under here. And West of La Risa, yes, that would explain it. Right, that's an easier explanation. Yes, in the elbow, but it's not actually the elbow; it's just underneath the elbow. Lorena, good to see you. We're talking about medical English, and we've only started recently, so you haven't missed very much. We talk about a runny nose. When you have a cold, and you have mucus running out of your nose, that's called a runny nose. The double N means that it is pronounced ah again. Of course, remember that is not constipation. Constipation is the inability to defecate. Do not call a cold constipation, because that will make English people laugh. A slipped disc. The reason for the second P here is because of the to make the vowel sound short. Slipped disc, of course, has assonance. It isn't really a slipped disc. It's a ruptured disc between your vertebrae, but we use the expression slipped disc. A stubbed toe. When you hit your toe against a piece of furniture, for example, we say a stubbed toe because of the double B, the U is pronounced ah. And we talk about tennis elbow. If you play a lot of tennis, you can strain your elbow one way or the other. And that's why there are two N's in tennis. If there was only one N, it would be tennis. And we don't say that. And this rule is, in fact, applied to Latin words in general. So, for example, glottis in English is spelt with two T's and is pronounced glottis. We wouldn't say glotis because there are two T's. We might pronounce it as glotis if we spelt it like the Spanish do. Similarly with patella, patella has two L's, and so the E is pronounced E. Okay? So that basic rule is something that you should be very much aware of. If you still don't understand what I'm talking about in terms of I consonant E, or in terms of doubling the consonant, ask me again on the forum and I will give you further explanation there. So this idea of vowel, consonant, plus an ending affects whole families of words in English. One of those families is itis, which refers to an inflammatory disease. So we talk about appendicitis, arthritis, bronchitis, conjunctivitis, hepatitis, laryngitis, meningitis, pharyngitis, and tonsillitis. Any word ending I-T-S-E in any medical term is going to be pronounced itis. You can count on that. Tonsillitis, by the way, is what you call a amygdalitis. What language am I speaking? For us, things at the back of your throat or the back of your mouth are your tonsils. The amygdalas are there only in your brain. Of course, in Spanish, you use amygdala for both. So amygdalitis would be the inflammation of your amygdalas in your brain, which would be, given that that is the seat of things like fear and strong emotions, amygdalitis in English, I don't think it exists, but if it did exist, it would be horrendous. What you call amygdalitis, we call tonsillitis. And it's also true of the big family of words that end in osis. So we say arthrosis, cirrhosis, diagnosis, fibrosis, halitosis, osteoporosis, prognosis, sclerosis, thrombosis, and tuberculosis. Tuberculosis, because it's a very long word, is often referred to as TB, by the way. And the same sort of thing happens with a scope. So we have an endoscope, a gastroscope, or a stethoscope. And it also affects all sorts of individual words, like the ones we are off you there. Angina, anus, fever, placebo, pneumonia, vagus nerve, virus, and plague. The only problem with all of that type of rule is when we have a vowel V followed by V followed by a consonant ending. So, for example, and this tends to lead to, the problem there is that we can't normally double the letter V. We can very occasionally in three or four words, but we don't normally double V because it ends up looking like a W, which we don't like. And so we have a number of cases which are contradictory. We talk about the Roman poet Ovid, but for some reason people have decided that the current pandemic is going to be called COVID-19. It would make more sense, since we already have Ovid, to say COVID-19. And if you say COVID-19, anybody's going to understand you. But we say COVID-19, I'm afraid. Next slide. At the same time, English tends to be full of words which reflect the fact that they come from Greek. So the three or four characteristics of Greek spelling that we incorporate are using PH to show that an F sound, a F sound, comes from Greek. The spelling RRH to reflect the Greek letter rho. The fact that Greek words that come from Greek, which you would tend to write that we would pronounce with a K sound, are spelled CH to reflect the Greek letter chi, and the fact that the Greek words from Greek tends to have TH pronounced as rather than Z. Z comes from Norse, from the Vikings, whereas TH comes from the sound tends to come from Greek. So in those examples we have there, we have diphtheria, don't say diphtheria. It's diphtheria, emphysema, muscular dystrophy, I can't say it properly, muscular dystrophy. Of course, Y, is also reflects the fact that a word comes from Greek. Phlegm, thysis, the PH there is actually silent, even though it's written. Syphilis, thymus, and typhoid. Okay, so those spellings are because they come from Greek. We have cirrhosis with the double RH, tends to mean that the previous vowel sound is short, but it doesn't, the fact that it's double RH doesn't mean that we have R or anything Spanish like that. Catarrh, where we don't even really pronounce the double RH. Diarrhea, gonorrhea, hemorrhage, and rhinoplasty. A rhinoplasty in everyday English would be called a nose job. Notice those spellings with O, E, A, and A, E. Those spellings are in British English. In American English, the O and the A, those letters that are in red, are omitted. And with in terms of the CH, we talk about a chemist's shop. A chemist's is a way, there's the way, sorry, excuse me. I'm just trying to get my, no, don't go all the way, just go a little bit of the way. 1 second. I will make the size a little bit smaller. And that will solve the problem. Right. Try again. Chemists is the way the British English people in colloquially refer to a pharmacy. Cholera, obviously in Spanish, cholera, but we spell it with CH. Hypochondriac, hypochondria, again CH. Psychosis. And in fact, the word ache. Now, ache actually comes from an Middle English word, and it should be pronounced H, but it isn't because in the Renaissance, people decided that it probably came from akos in Greek. It doesn't come from akos in Greek. It comes from ache in Anglo-Saxon. Anyway, we pronounce that word ache. Another huge exception is the word asthma. Now, asthma was spelt A-S-M-A, asthma, as you would expect, in Middle English. But as happened with a number of words in the Renaissance, they said, oh, it's very important to reflect the fact that it comes from Greek. And they added the T-H, even though that T-H was silent, making it a word which is much more difficult to spell than it should be. In terms of the British versus American spelling, in this case, for example, like hemorrhage, we have words like feces or pediatrics, which again, in British English are spelled A-E, and in American English are just spelled E. And in terms of the O-E, as here in gonorrhea, we also have the word fetus. Fetus is spelled O-E in British English. In both cases, curiously, in fact, it is spelled with an F, not with a P-H. But anyway, there you go. What are you going to do? Right. So, such is the need to use terms basically that comes from Greek and to a lesser extent that come from Latin, that learning medical English is very, very similar to learning a foreign language. It has been calculated by the time a normal English person has been trained to become a doctor, they have had to learn 10,000 medical terms, which is basically the equivalent of learning a language. I would have thought that you don't yet know 10,000 words in English. You should be at your level at about 6,000, 7,000 words in English. So that gives you some idea of the amount of medical training in Britain, which is taken up with learning words rather than with actually learning how to save people's lives. And so we have to ask ourselves, why is there this enormous reverence for Greek medical terms? After all, Galen and co. held up the advance of Western medicine for 1,500 years. Because of the Greeks, Western doctors only started to have a net positive impact on people's health in the mid-19th century. For instance, bloodletting was the most common medical practice from antiquity until the late 19th century. And we all know that bloodletting, taking blood out of people's veins, is almost always counterproductive. The Romans had a proverb which translates as, "The doctor is more often to be feared than the disease." Chaucer reflects that idea in the 14th century. 1,500 years after the Romans, the French had a similar saying. Even today in English, we have an adjective, iatrogenic, which comes from Greek and means an illness caused by doctors. So there is a huge problem with the fact that our medicine comes from ancient Greek, and it seems strange that we maintain all of these words when we have, in most cases, perfectly good English words. Well, the reason for this is specifically to make what doctors say unintelligible. As long ago as the 13th century, doctors like Arnaldus of Villanova, Arnaldus de Villanova was a Valencian, by the way, were arguing that doctors should use obscure language to ensure that their patients didn't understand them. So doctors do it on purpose, and the way they do it on purpose in English is to use technical terms which basically are Greek and are not English. The language of anatomy and of medicine in Spanish is much, much, much closer to ordinary Spanish than it is in English. Your problem, of course, is just the opposite. Your problem is to understand the everyday words that normal people use rather than to understand the anatomical terms. If you need the anatomical terms in your daily life, you will find that they are at least they are very, very easy to recognize, whether they are actually spelled. They might be spelled slightly differently, but you will be able to tell what they are. So that the joke that you can see on the screen is reflecting the fact that we use so much language which is not easily recognizable. And this joke suggests that ordinary English speakers wouldn't be able to tell which are the Greek philosophers and which are the illnesses. Ailments, by the way, is an illness, is a sickness. It doesn't have anything to do with food, with alimento. Ailment is an illness. So we won't bother with the philosophers, but looking at some of those diseases, you can see that they follow the rules that I mentioned earlier. So the first ailment is typhus, the I followed by a single consonant, because PH counts as a single consonant, followed by the ending, typhus. Septicemia. Septicemia is the E is long because we have vowel consonant and the ending, the vowel and the stressed syllable. In British English, septicemia would be spelled with an A after the C. The same sort of thing happens at the bottom of the other list with uremia, which would be spelt with an A in British English. But titanus is pronounced titanus and not titanus because there is a double N. Similarly, pertussis is pronounced pertussis and not pertussis or anything like that because of the double S. That, by the way, pertussis is not what we normally refer to in English, and anybody who is not a doctor will not understand you. In normal English, that is called whooping cough. Whooping cough. Okay. Right. So, as I hope some of you have at least found, on the forum, I left you this quiz, this matching game, basically, which involves deciding which of the technical terms. Hello, sorry. Sorry, what? You just arrived. Fine, not a problem. Hello, sorry. Ah, right. Hello. Whatever, I suppose. I don't know. I'll continue. So in the left-hand column, yeah, don't worry. Not a problem. These things happen. In the left-hand column, we have the technical terms, and in the right-hand column, we have the everyday terms. So if you're in a position to print that out and have that beside you, it might make the class more fun, if that's the right word. Okay, but anyway, you will have by the end of this, we will have all of that filled out, and slide number 29 or something like that actually gives you the correct correspondence. So you don't have to do that if you don't want to. You can do that if you feel like it. So our first term is clavicle. Does anybody know why a clavicle is called a clavicle? What does clavicle mean in, I would say, Latin? I'm guessing Latin, claviculus. Anybody know what claviculus means? We'll give you 10 seconds. No. Okay, well, fair enough, no idea. Clavicle is related to clavichord, for example, the type of piano. A clavicle means a small key. A small key, like to open a small lock. And if you are a Roman, you think for some reason that bone looks a little bit like a small key. Not quite sure why, but that's why we say clavicle. And apparently that is the easiest bone in the body to break. So what would we call a clavicle in everyday English? If you were, for example, a doctor, a Spanish doctor working in Britain, if you refer to people's clavicle, then most people would not understand what you're talking about, and you would have to translate it. The collarbone, excellent. Okay, it's basically in where your collar is. So we talk about a collarbone normally. Good. By the way, you will find throughout the presentation there are little videos relating to the bit of vocabulary we're talking about, so you can hear it pronounced a lot. And if you're interested in anything particular, you can look at that. Right. Oops. The coccyx. Of course, the coccyx is the lower end of your spinal column, etc. Does anybody know why we say coccyx? Well, I won't waste too much time waiting to see if there are answers. No, good. Okay. Apparently, Galen thought that the coccyx looked like the beak of a cuckoo. Coccyx in Greek means cuckoo, yeah, like the bird which puts its egg in other birds' nests, so that they have to look after the cuckoo's young. So if you think about it, it looks to us more like a parrot's beak or something like that, but it looks a little bit like the beak, like the mouth of a bird. What would you call that in English? Sorry, in everyday English, a coccyx. Again, many native English speakers would not understand coccyx. Exactly, a tailbone. So it is the appendage that used to be when we were monkeys for our tail, and so we talk about it as a tailbone. And of course, you talk about a cat's tail or a dog's tail or a horse's tail. We only have one word. We don't have two like you do. Interesting factoid. The Duke of Wellington, who fought in Spain during the Peninsular War, had an extended coccyx. So he basically had a tail, and he had to have a special saddle with a hole in the back on his horse so that he could sit properly with his tail. Bet you didn't know that. Right. So what is often the case in English is that we have the adjective here, cutaneous, for example, relates to a word that you can recognize, but the actual name of the organ doesn't. So we can talk about the cutaneous organ or we could talk about the pulmonary organ, or we could talk about the hepatic organ, or we could talk about the renal organ. And you would recognize those words, but you wouldn't actually recognize the normal English word for things. So what is the normal word for your cutaneous organ? Anybody? We have more people joining us. Skin, exactly. Okay, so skin is how we would refer to your cutaneous organ. And I will keep going because I have nothing more to say about skin. Dun, dun, dun. Right. That gets more complicated. How would you we normally refer to a cerebral embolism or a cerebral thrombosis? Does anybody know? Exactly, a stroke. Very good. Now, stroke is a very, very complicated word in English. The basic idea of stroke is a smooth movement. So if you play golf, which I hope you don't, very unecological sport, but anyway, if you play golf, your golf stroke is your swing, your movement. Yeah, and that can be a very hard, fast movement, or it can be a slow, gentle movement. You stroke a cat or you stroke a dog, and it's not the idea of hitting the dog or the cat, it's the idea of caressing it. So they're really quite different meanings between the verb to stroke and the noun to stroke. But that is the origin of this term. And originally in the 16th century, the expression was the stroke of God's hand. So the idea of if you had an embolism or a thrombosis, then that was el golpe del mano de Dios, basically. Hello. Hola. Hello. Can I help? Carmen, can I help? What's the problem? Are you busy writing? Presumably. Well, anyway, if a message comes up, I will answer it. In fact, the an alternative word for an embolism or a thrombosis is an apoplexy that you can probably associate with Spanish, and that actually comes from apoplessein. Which is a Greek word which means to strike down. So this idea of it being some type of blow to the head, which is presumably divine, because no, you don't actually see somebody hitting you when you have this blow to the head, is behind this idea of stroke, etc., etc. Come on, open. Thank you. And open. Right, and of course, in 20th century medicine, we now know that there are different types of stroke. We can talk about a thrombotic stroke, where there is blood clot, or an embolic stroke, where there is fatty plaque or a blood clot. Not quite sure what the difference is there. And we can also talk about a cerebral hemorrhage, where the blood vessel breaks open. You can't see anything. Oh dear. Well, leave and come back in. That usually solves the problem. If you leave the group and then come back in, that's usually normality is returned by doing that. If not, I don't know any other solution. You can't hear anything. Well, can you read anything? Exactly. Yes. Good. Yes, exactly. Sorry, that was Elena saying that. Right. Can you hear me and see me and etc. now? Carmen? I think it's Carmen. No, no, names, names. You've left. Ah, oh, no, but you haven't come back yet. Well, are you coming back? Come back, Carmen. If she didn't come back, doesn't seem to be coming back. As my father, who is a scientist, always says, technology is wonderful until it goes wrong, and then it isn't. Okay, well, I'm not sure if Carmen is coming back, but we will continue since this is recording, and otherwise it will. Oh, come on, behave. Right. So, the big bone in the upper part of your leg is called the femur. How would we refer to that in everyday English? How would you refer to the femur in everyday English? Hello, Carmen, can you see us now? Can you hear us now? Yes, excellent, good. Thigh bone, but you spelt it incorrectly. It's THIGH. Thigh bone. Thigh bone. Okay. And of course, the muscles in your upper leg are your thigh. The muscles at the back tend to be referred to as your hamstring, because this is a ham, like what you eat of pigs. A very common sporting injury is a hamstring injury. It tends to be the other situation in which we use the term hamstring is if you want to hobble an animal like a horse, you cut the tendon of the hamstring, and then it cannot run away. Very cruel and very unpleasant, but that is where the term hamstring is also used. So that is your thigh. Above that, of course, we have the pelvis, which is easily recognizable in Spanish. But each side of the pelvis are called your hips, HIP, hip. And hip became, it's right hip. Hip in the 1930s became a word that was used to mean to be cool, to be sort of fashionable, etc., etc. For example, in the jazz world, people talked about a hip cat. The reason that we use this word is actually comes from westerns, from cowboy films. Somebody who could shoot from the hip, they could take their pistol out and instead of pointing it like an American policeman, in front of them, but could shoot from the hip very quickly, was cool, etc. And from that, we got the word hippie. So hippies are very unlikely to shoot from the hip because most hippies are meant to be anti-violence. But that is why we have that family of words from hip to hippie to hip cat to etc. There you go. Come on. Thinking very hard now. Very, very hard. Lots of thinking. That's boring. Come on. Right. Your hepatic organ. How would we. Ooh. Okay. You will get bored before I do. Come on. Thank you. How do we refer to the hepatic organ in English, in everyday English? This you should know, people. The liver. Excellent. Right. It's called the liver. The liver, not the lever. Relating liver. Relating liver. not quite sure why he said relating liver. Right, liver. Liver, and which in German is die Leber, you'll be interested to know. And Leber as a verb in German means to live. So probably the liver is called the liver because it is necessary in order to live. That's why I would say the liver. Obviously, maybe your heart is even more necessary to live, but that's another question. Does anybody know, interesting fact, why in Spanish you talk about the hígado? This is not necessary for your English, but is necessary for you to be interesting at dinner parties. So does anybody know why we say hígado? Ah, well, you should do. Hígado comes from ficatum, and ficatum was a liver that was stuffed with figs, with higos. So hígado is an animal's hígado filled with higos. That apparently was one of the Romans' favorite dishes. Their favorite way of eating figs was to stuff them inside a liver and then to cook that. Sounds fun. So I expect you all to try this dish tonight and to tell me how tasty it is. I, of course, will not be eating ficatum because I'm a vegetarian. Right, next one. So we talk about the intestines, and intestines is a word that the vast majority of native English speakers will understand. Intestines is not a problem to understand, but what would be the more natural way of referring to the intestines, the more popular way of referring to the intestines? The gut, very good. And of course, we also talk about to have guts, which means to have agallas. Agallas originally referred to testicles Spanish, but we refer to intestines. If you have your intestines, then you are apparently brave in English. Slightly strange. We would also refer to the whole abdominal area of the abdomen as your belly. So belly is a popular word as well as gut. Just in case. We have a certain confusion in English between the whole region for the stomach and the intestines. We will tend to refer to the whole stomach and intestine region as the belly, and a stomach ache may well be, if somebody talks about having a stomach ache or a belly ache, they may well be referring to a pain in their intestines and not necessarily in their stomach. But we tend to be slightly confused about that whole area. The mandible, again, a word which most everyday English people probably would not understand. How do we say mandible in English, in everyday English? Good, the jaw. And that, of course, explains why the film is called Jaws. Jaws does not mean tiburón. Some Spanish people think that jaws somehow means tiburón. It doesn't. It means mandible. So, for example, we talk about the jaws of death. To snatch something from the jaws of death means to save somebody's life. The jaws of life are these pneumatic cutting tools that are used for breaking open cars. And when there's a car crash, and there are these tools, pneumatic tools, which are used to open up the car to get somebody out to save their life. Those things are called the jaws of life. I don't know. I have no idea how you say the jaws of life in Spanish. anyway, you can find that out for yourselves. Not related to medicine, of course. Right. The esophagus. Esophagus with an O at the beginning in British English. Esophagus with an E at the beginning in American English. How do we say the esophagus in everyday English? Ooh, they don't know that one. They don't know that one. They don't know it. The answer is the gullet, written gullet, but pronounced gullet. And if you need to help to remember the word gullet is related to the Latin word gula, which means throat or appetite. The Spanish word gula is ultimately related indirectly to the English word gullet. Because the screen isn't properly set. But if I want to press my record button and to be able to see who is involved, I need to have my not be able to see my face, which is also quite a good thing. Anyway, that's all right. Your esophagus can also be referred to sometimes as your food pipe, pipe in the sense of tube down which food goes. So the esophagus can be called the food pipe. And we come to the patella. How do we say patella in everyday English? Patella is a word that ordinary English people will not be able to understand. If you talk about the patella, the knee cap. Yes, I think on your list it says the knee cap. It should say the knee cap anyway. If it doesn't, that's a mistake. So it is a cap, like what you might get on top of your tube of toothpaste, etc., etc. A cap, a cover over your knee. A patella, by the way, is the Latin word for a little shallow dish. A little dish in Latin is patella, and the shape of course, your kneecap is a little bit like a little dish. So there you go. More. Number 11. Perspire, perspiration. How do we say that in everyday English? Sweat. Good. Do not confuse sweat with sweet. They are spelt differently and pronounced differently. This word is pronounced sweat. And so you can see there is the sweat gland, etc., etc., etc. Moving on rapidly. Go away. How do we say the renal organ? Renal, because there is only one N, of course. How do we say the renal organ in English? The kidney. Good. We don't really know why the kidney is called the kidney. It just is. We just have to accept that. But there you go. Kidney, not kidney or anything like that. Kidney. One way to remember this is... Oh, come on. Close. Right. Is this type of thing, which you will have seen used in television series about hospitals like ER, urgencias for you. This thing is called in British English a kidney dish because it is the same shape, more or less, as a kidney. And of course, kidney dish has assonance. Unfortunately, the Americans call it an emesis dish. Sorry, an emesis basin, which doesn't help with your learning the word. But in British English, it's called a kidney dish. Right, now we get into the fun area of contagious diseases. And unfortunately, my list of symbols is a little bit on top of this. But anyway, rubella. Does anybody know how to say rubella in rubella is German measles. Yes, I haven't actually got my answers in front of me. I'm pretty sure that's right. I think so. Sorry, I should know this. I knew this last year when I was at the other university, but I've forgotten this. Anyway, rubella means reddish things, things that are sort of red. We'll move rapidly on since I forgot the actual, which is which. Come on. Of course, it is politically incorrect now to associate diseases with countries. So although we still, I think, tend to say the Spanish flu, just because that is so, that is a historical word now. You shouldn't talk about the Chinese coronavirus, and you shouldn't talk about German measles, you should talk about rubella. That is the idea, at least. Again, amongst everyday people, rubella tends to be, oh, what an exciting mask you have. Rubella still seems to be called German measles. Now, in Spanish, you tend to use rubella and rubiola as synonyms, as I understand it. And this is perfectly logical, because in fact, rubiola means small red things. So the difference between small red things and reddish things is really rather small. How do we say rubiola in English? Anybody? Any idea? Rubiola? Rubiola? Measles, correct. Measles in English. So rubella and rubiola are not synonyms in English. They are completely different diseases. And we can illustrate that with this exciting cartoon. Rubiola is ordinary measles. Rubella is German measles. And Roseolum infantum, they have given another Latin or Greek name here, but Roseola infantum is often called baby measles in everyday English. So you can, at a later date, stop the recording and read all of these exciting symptoms relating to those three diseases. But we haven't got time now, because we've still got another 22 pages to go. So I will move on, if the machine will let me. And back to bones. Your scapula over here. How would you say scapula in everyday English? Any idea? Scapula. Shoulder blade, good. It looks a little bit like a cutting implement, like the blade of a spade, or the blade of a big knife or something like that. So it's called a shoulder blade. Shoulder is, in fact, etymologically probably related to the word shield. If you enjoy watching the TV series Vikings like I do, you will be aware of the word shield for the protective thing that they create their shield wall with. And shield is related to shoulder. The shield is normally carried on the shoulder. Blah, 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 blah. Not sure what those is anybody, it doesn't really matter. We will continue. Come on. Right. And um We there have the vertebral column or the spinal column or the spine. With its different regions, the cervical region, the thoracic region, the lumbar, the sacrum, and the corax. Well, that doesn't help. Well, that doesn't help my class very much. Anyway, how would normal English people refer to their vertebral column or their spinal column or their spine? I mean, they might say their spine, which of course is a false friend. Backbone, yes. It is obviously lots and lots of bones, something like 33 bones, some of them fused together. It is not one bone, but it does, of course, function as one structure, which is why we talk about the backbone in singular. And we have here the sternum. How would you say your sternum? How would you say sternum in everyday English? Ha ha. You don't know. No? Okay. The sternum is your breastbone. Okay, your breastbone. This part of your body is your breast. Yes, but I've already said it now. Too late. Okay, a bit of revision. Yes, breastbone. Too late. What is the red... Don't worry. What is the red arrow pointing to? This thing back here. Oh, you've forgotten already. Okay. Shoulder blade or spatula? No, spatula? No. I can't remember what you say. Shoulder blade is how we would normally say it. And the black? What's the black question mark pointing to? What's this thing? Four. Three, two, one, zero. No, you've forgotten. Most breakable bone in the body. Yes, the collarbone or the clavicle. Good. Okay, so those are those. Yes. Right. And number 18, we have what would be... Oh, sorry. I had some more exciting things to say. I'm going to go back first. If it will let me. So, what do we call the entire structure here? In other words, how would you say caja toracica? Thoracica. How would you say caja thoracica? Does anybody know? No? Well, these bones, all of these bones, are called ribs, apart from the bottom one, which is a false rib. And so this is called the rib cage. So we see it like a cage, like what you might keep a bird in, and this is your rib cage. I'll write that down for you. And the ribs and the rib cage is quite an interesting illustration of how different we are to medieval people. In 43, Vesalius established that men and women had the same number of ribs. Before that, for well over a millennium, people believed that men had one fewer ribs than women because that's what it says in the Bible. And nobody bothered to count them. incredibly, for 1,500 years, nobody bothered to count how many ribs men had and how many ribs women had. And it was only in the Renaissance that somebody pointed out that we all have the same number of ribs. So that's an interesting fact for you. And we move on. Hopefully. Are we going to move on? I'd like to move on. Try again. Right. So, a suture, and to suture is the technical term for what's happening there. How would you refer to that in everyday English? Stitches, very good. So there are four stitches there. Again, possibly people who are who enjoy medical dramas would have some idea of sutures. Sew up. I've never heard of sew up. We say stitches normally. But we don't, I mean, apart from people who watch those programs regularly, we would only understand stitches. We wouldn't understand sutures. Stitching, by the way, was probably invented in the Stone Age. We have needles made of bone and animal hair used for making sutures, for making stitches from the Stone Age. So this is actually very, very ancient type of medical procedure, interestingly. Right, and here we have the tibia. What is the name of the tibia in everyday English? The shin bone, good. So the front of your lower leg is your shin. And if you wear protective pads in some sports for that, those are called shin pads. Make sure you do not confuse your shin, with an S, with your chin, with a C. So chin, shin, down below. The tibia, by the way, tibia means flute, and some ancient flutes were made out of animals' tibias, and the shape of the tibia is considered to be similar to that of a flute. The fibula is, as it says there, the fibula is called the calf bone because the back of your leg is known as your calf, and fibula means buckle or fastener, because the combination of the tibia and the fibula look a little bit like a brooch, at least if you are a Roman, they do. And the trachea, pronounced trachea, don't say trachea or anything like that, trachea, because it comes from Greek, is this thing. How would you refer to this in everyday English? The throat is at the top, but the trachea is the whole thing. The windpipe, good, it's a tube, it's a pipe, so like the food pipe, we have a windpipe for air, wind being air. Curiously, the Greeks called their windpipes arteria. Our word for artery and your word for arteria come from the Greek word for a windpipe. Which is not very helpful. But anyway, on the picture you can see it says here tracheal cartilage. Cricoid, I think, cartilage, thyroid cartilage, and the Adam's apple, which is this here, The nuez is called the Adam's apple, by the way. Anyway, cartilage, which is obviously easy for you to recognize, is in everyday English is called gristle. And especially, for example, if you find it in food, it is called gristle. These are your lungs, your right lung and your left lung. Right. Urticaria. How would you say urticaria in everyday English? Well, interestingly, our word urticaria is related to your word ortiga. Exactly, hives is correct. So we also talk about it as a nettle rash because ortiga in English is a nettle. The plant is called a nettle. So urticaria is also called nettle rash, or especially in American English, hives. So a rash, by the way, a rash is any type of eruption on the skin. Hives is an eruption which is itchy, which you have to scratch. Yeah, because pica. So hives is more specific word than just a rash. The uterus in everyday English is, anybody? The womb, good. It was in fact wamb in Anglo-Saxon, but, and wamb meant abdomen for both men and women. So Anglo-Saxon men had a womb in one sense. But the word was, because of the influence of the word woman, both the pronunciation and the spelling changed towards womb. Right, back to our diseases. Come on, diseases. Varicella. How would you say varicella in English? Varicella in British English. Varicella in American English. Strange people. Good. Chicken pox. Often written as one word. Chicken pox. Good. Pox means pustule. Pustula. And so it refers to the marks on the skin. If somebody's face can be described as pockmarked, for example. And the reason we say chicken pox is because chickens are relatively harmless and varicella is relatively harmless. Slightly strange expression. But there we have another cartoon explaining the differences. So varicella, chicken pox, which can manifest itself many years later as shingles. Shingles in Spanish is, how would you say shingles in Spanish? Herpes zoster. Anybody? Well, you say culebrilla. And you say culebrilla, yes, because the mark is considered to look like a small snake. Our word shingles comes from the Latin cinculus, which means girdle. So it means like a belt that you would wear around your waist because it's about where you would have your belt, perhaps. Belt, of course, in German is Gürtel. You know that because of La Operación Gürtel, which was an operation which the police called Operación Gürtel because it was in relation to El Señor Correa. So the Spanish police were demonstrating their love of languages by calling it La Operación Gurte. But anyway, all of that is related to our word shingles. Fascinating stuff. Right, variola, which is a different problem and a more serious problem. How do we say variola in English? Any idea? How would you say variola? Smallpox, good. The Latin word variola, good. One word. The Latin word variola means pustule, means pustula, or basically pox, and is in fact related to our word various. Varios y variola are etymologically related. Smallpox is called smallpox because they to distinguish it from the great pox. Does anybody know what the great pox was? Lots of clapping. What was the great pox? Great pox was syphilis. So we needed to distinguish between those two things, and that is how we did it. Did you know that syphilis was one of the causes of the Reformation? Basically, when the Spanish brought syphilis back from the Americas, the form of syphilis was much more virulent than the syphilis of the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. And basically, if you got syphilis in the 16th century, your nose would fall off and your ears would fall off and things like that. It was a far more serious disease then than what it became later. And so by the 1520s and 1530s, you had a lot of bishops and priests and people like that who had the very obvious physical symptoms of syphilis. And this demonstrated that having sex was as common amongst the priesthood, amongst members of the church, as it was amongst the general population, if not perhaps more so. And so this was something that very, very much undermined the prestige of the church, because the idea was, yes, they have certain privileges, for example, in the courts and things like that, but they have to abstain from sex. Once it became physically clear that large parts of the clergy were participating in sex, that helped to spread the Reformation. Again, interesting stuff. Next one. Right, we have the vesicular sac. How would you refer to your vesicular sac if you had to in everyday English? Again, vesicular sac is something that most ordinary English speakers would not understand. Well, the vesicular sac is your urinary bladder. We would tend to just say bladder. Bladder is related etymologically. But could you close the door, please? That door. The bladder is related to the word blow, and the idea is that a bladder is something that can be inflated. So, for example, we refer to the thing inside a football or a rugby ball as the bladder, what is inflated, and then you have leather on the outside. The only time we talk about a urinary bladder is when we have to distinguish it from a vesicula biliar. How would you say vesicula biliar? Does anybody know? It's not on your list, I don't think. The vesicula biliar is the gallbladder. Gall is another word for bilis, so that is why we say that. Okay, since we're on the subject, which we're not, I'm not quite sure why I put this question here, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Can any of you name the Black Death, the White Death, the Blue Death, and the Yellow Death in English, in everyday English, or in any language at all? What is the Black Death? I want alternative names for the Black Death, the White Death, the Blue Death, and the Yellow Death. Right, peste, but that's Spanish. How do you say la peste in English? Bubonic plague. Remember that pest in English is a false friend. Pest is a word that's used for irritating children and for animals that are considered negative. So alimañas are pests. What the Americans would tend to refer to as vermin are pests. But we talk about plagues for the Black Death, things like the Black Death, the bubonic plague. What would be the White Death? Epidemic? Yeah, pretty much. What is the White Death? Anybody? The White Death? With ice? No. The White Death is tuberculosis. TB is the White Death. The Blue Death? Any idea, anybody? The Blue Death is cholera, and the Yellow Death is yellow fever, logically. Okay, just if you come across, especially those terms tend to be used quite a lot in literature, so you may come across any of those terms used in literature. There is also the Red Death, now that I think about it, and I can't remember what that refers to. I think that may refer to syphilis. I think that Caliban refers to the Red Death or the Red Plague in The Tempest, but I may be wrong. Something like that. We will continue. So there are the answers to those things if you didn't get anything. Again, I'm not going to waste time. The door, please. I'm not going to waste time going through that list. If you want, you can later stop the recording and check your answers. So I just want to look at a few other medical subjects. Ooh. Close. Thank you. One important subject is addictive foodstuffs in relation to we are what we eat, and the reason why the Americans have the worst rate, one of the reasons why the Americans have the worst rate of coronavirus is that they have the worst immune systems in the world, and the reason they have the worst immune systems in the world is their food is awful. So there is an explanation of why Americans eat awful food in this book called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. To hook means to cause people to be addicted. And it is useful if you're talking about diet to be able to pronounce those words properly. So we talk about salt, and one way of remembering the pronunciation salt is to talk about rock salt. Rock salt is salt which comes from rock rather than salt which comes from the sea. That is rock salt, and you can hear oh. Sugar, the pronunciation sugar can cause problems. So this advertisement is quite helpful. Sugar shouldn't be anybody's daddy. Sugar shouldn't. It's the same sound. That may help you to remember that. And then, of course, fat is fat and is easy enough to remember. Some more diseases. We mentioned very quickly cholera. Cholera comes from the Greek word that meant diarrhea. And cholera doesn't mean angry. Dengue or dengue. Dengue, British English dengue, and American English dengue fever is a nasty disease spread by mosquitoes. And this illness is called Ebola. Do not pronounce it Ebola if you're talking English. Ebola. We've forgotten about Ebola, haven't we? We have been distracted by other things. But Ebola is still there. More diseases too. Influenza, from the Italian word for influence, is a homophone. We normally talk about flu, and is a homophone of the word flu. Lyme disease, it is named after the town Lyme in Connecticut, and it is spread by ticks. This amusing and friendly animal diving into somebody's skin is a tick. And there is a little bit, yes, yuck, it is not very nice. I'll get rid of it very quickly, don't worry. But here you have the symptoms for a cold, for a catarrh, and the symptoms for flu. I will get rid of the tick as quickly as I can. Come on. And more diseases, even more, I should say more diseases three rather than more diseases two. Malaria, pronounced malaria. One way of remembering it is the malaria scare. Malaria scare. Air is the sound there. Nothing much else to say about malaria. Mumps. Mumps is paperas. Paperas, by the way, is related to papo and papada, a double chin. And of course, one of the symptoms of mumps is that this whole area tends to be inflated. So it looks a little bit like a double chin. I'm not going to go back to the picture. But when we're talking about flu, I should have mentioned that avian influenza tends to be referred to in everyday English as bird flu. Bird flu. And more problems. Rabies, which doesn't mean rage. Rabies is just the disease. Do not confuse it, rabia, with rabia, the rabioso person. And there you have some explanation about it. Scurvy, the condition scurvy, the adjective is scorbutic. So that will help you to remember what the word actually means. Scurvy is a deficiency in vitamin C. And of course, that is when the British Navy realized that scurvy on British ships was caused by a deficiency in vitamin C, they started insisting that sailors ate a lot of fruit. And sailors going to America were associated with eating lots of lime. So the Americans started calling English people limeys. You will still occasionally hear to English people being called limeys in America. And in Australia, they had to eat a lot of apples. And so they were called pommies, from the French word for an apple, in Australia. So that is why those two words are used. Sleeping sickness. Can't remember how you say sleeping sickness in Spanish. Enfermedad del sueño, I think, perhaps. Anyway, that is transmitted by the tsetse fly, which is called the tsetse fly in American English. Very different pronunciation in British English. Tsetse. Good. Okay, and the tsetse fly in American English. Few more symptoms and things. A bruise is a contusion, which is the technical word. Bruise rhymes, sorry, is a homophone of bruise. Constipation does not mean a catarrh. Constipation is the inability to defecate. I mentioned that earlier. Cough, pronounced cough. This word is pronounced cough. And one way of remembering that, as we saw a couple of weeks ago, is with the expression cough drops. Cough drops. To cough something up is a euphemism for to vomit. And in the 1920s, with the Spanish flu, people used to say coughs and sneezes spread diseases, trap the germs by using your handkerchief. The trap your germs by using a handkerchief doesn't really rhyme. But anyway, coughs and sneezes spread diseases. And that is still true in our current pandemic. So we all know about how to sneeze better now. Intoxication. Intoxication means drunkenness. It does not mean food poisoning. If you want to talk about food poisoning, use the expression food poisoning. One second, excuse me. Marina. Me voy a andar. Vale. Entonces a lo mejor no estoy cuando voy a ver.
Vale.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh,
bueno, no sé si es que faltan 42 minutos.
Migraine. Okay. Don't know, but I will take it. Migraine or migraine, you can pronounce it either way. Up to you. Numb. If you lose the sensation, for example, in one of your fingers or your hand or something like that, we say it is numb. Okay, so if it's temporarily paralyzed. Pus is the nasty stuff that comes out of some type of wound. Don't confuse that with pus. Pus. A pus is a cat, spelled with a double S. Pus, spelled with a single S, is pronounced a. So there's all sorts of possibilities to get confused there. Sneeze, again, we have sneezes, rhymes with diseases, which I mentioned earlier. More body parts. Almost finished. Blood, yeah, don't say blood or anything like that. Blood and flood are the only words that are pronounced like that. A mnemonic might be bloodlust, an uncontrollable desire to kill or injure. Heart. Your heart is a homophone of heart, as you will know from innumerable Renaissance poems where they make a pun on heart and heart. Hard-hearted. We talk about somebody being hard-hearted if they are passionless. Your heel at the back of your foot is a homophone of to heal, to cure. Heal. Limbs are your arms and legs. So if we want to say, we don't tend to say extremities, it's much more common to talk about limbs. Lung, pronounced lung. The etymology is originally related to the word light. It was an organ which is not heavy, it's a very light organ. And that's why we talk about lungs. Muscle. A muscle is a homophone of muscle, the seafood, so moule in French, muscle, mejillones, mejillon in Spanish. Muscle comes from the Latin word musculus, which means a little mouse. They saw that the bicep looked like a little mouse to them. Stomach is pronounced stomach. And one way of remembering that is a stomach pump. This is a 19th century stomach pump No doubt a modern stomach pump doesn't really look like that. Thyroid, pronounced thyroid, your thyroid glands, and a lack of iodine in your diet is called goiter. Interestingly, the word stomach comes from the Greek word stomachos, which means a throat, which is strange. I don't know how all of that got confused, but anyway. The Midwest of the United States used to be called the goiter belt because a lack of iodine was very, very common in that area until people realized that that was the cause, because people in the Midwest, of course, didn't eat very much seafood or fish from the sea. And so they had a lack of iodine in their diet. That is one of the reasons why vegetarians have to eat Marmite and things like that, as well as sea salt. Otherwise, they can get goiter. Tongue is pronounced tongue, and the mnemonic could be your mother tongue, your lingua materna is a mother tongue. So, two more pages. So, the noun is breath, with a mnemonic. Breath of fresh air, a welcome change, breath. The verb is to breathe, breathe. The mnemonic, as easy as breathing, as easy as breathing, or to breathe easy, another expression. A medic in the US is a paramedic. A medic in the UK, informal UK English, can mean a doctor. The word physician is another word for a doctor. It does not mean a physicist. So somebody who studies the science of physics is a physicist, not a physician who is a medical doctor. Sane does not mean physically healthy, it means mentally healthy. So sane means cuerdo or cuerda. A sponge, pronunciation is a sponge. A swab, a cotton swab, these are cotton swabs here, cotton swabs, which the Americans call Q-tips because they are shaped a little bit like a Q, if you're American, apparently. And finally, the pronunciation of triage, triaje, where you use a colored system to say the importance that people should be treated. So here we have, for example, resuscitation means that people should be treated immediately. Emergency within 15 minutes. Urgency, 30 minutes. Less urgency, 60 minutes. Non-urgency, 120 minutes. So if you are kept waiting a long time in the ER, it should be because your condition is not urgent. And I don't know what the last page is. Remind you that to practice your pronunciation, I recommend the How to Pronounce Triage. But is that from French? Definitely from French, yes. Definitely. If you want to ensure that in whatever your special sphere of speciality is, where you use English, use How to Pronounce plus the word. And it is very, very useful to get your pronunciation correct. So this word is pronounced thysis, and they will show you the mouth movement, and you can hear it slow or quickly in British or American English. A very useful app that is too. And that is the end of my talk about medical English. I'm toying with different ideas about what to do in your last two talks. One of the things I was thinking of talking about, that my wife suggested actually, was talking about wordplay, all the different ways that English plays with words such as zeugma and snow clones and puns and different things like that. That would be one possibility. I could talk about false friends for an hour and a half. That's another possibility. I could talk about the history of English. Another possibility. Anyway, I will give that a think. If anybody has any suggestions, do feel free to make the suggestions soon, because obviously I have to prepare the talk. Make the history of English sounds great. You have a course on that. If I give you a talk on the history of English, it will be a heretical one. It will be going against what you learn in the history of English course. But so you won't be allowed to repeat the ideas in your in the course you have about that. Okay, right. Well, I will. We can go for the history of English. That's easy. I don't think I have had that yet. So fine. Well, the only thing is that, as I say, if you repeat my ideas, you will get in trouble, because there is an official version which makes no sense, and then there is the heretical version promoted by people like me. Okay, well, I will, depending on how well I do with my PECs and things like that, you will either have that next week or in our final tutorial, but I will definitely do a tutorial on the history of English. Good to see you all, or see your writing, and we will be in touch over the week, and I will see you next Monday. Bye-bye! Oh, come on, behave. Get in there.